Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Headwinds for the Obama agenda this week. The king of pop makes his exit. And from China, Americans learn the word Uyghur. In Rome today, as Congress slows on health care reform, the president was asked if it's do or die.
I never believe anything is do or die. But I really want to get it done by the August recess.
In Los Angeles, before a television audience of millions, Michael Jackson's 11-year-old daughter Paris bid her father an emotional farewell.
Ever since I was born, Daddy has been the best father you could ever imagine. And I just wanted to say I love him so much.
And in Western China, many dead as ethnic Uyghurs took pent-up anger to the streets. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Jobs, GM, the Obama agenda, Uyghurs? And your parting thoughts on Governor Palin, the G8 in Rome. Joining us now from Washington is Kathleen Parker, nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Kathleen Parker, great to have you back.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. Thank you.
And with us from Washington, Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, great to have you back as well.
And great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
And here from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kathleen, and Clarence.
Hello, Jack.
Here we go. Everybody's here. Let's hear one piece of sound. I want to get into this Obama agenda close to home first. On Tuesday, the numbers changed on Capitol Hill. Here's Al Franken, sworn in as the junior senator at last, I guess you'd say, from Minnesota.
I am going to work day and night to make sure that our kids have a great future and that America's best days lay ahead. I'm ready to get to work.
Okay, Al Franken's in. Clarence Page, the Democrats have 60 votes in the Senate, and yet there's a lot of talk of headwinds for Barack Obama, President Obama, this week, rather than sailing through on health care, climate goals, and more. What's going on with the Obama agenda? Is it a little becalming here for some reason?
Well, there's no guarantees in politics, and what we see happening in this case, as has happened with previous administrations and Congresses, is that when you do get a veto-proof majority, it empowers your moderates. It empowers those Democrats who might have some hesitation, say, "Well, I don't know," and then you know vote with the other side. So, nothing is guaranteed, but I think this is going to make a difference. As far as something like the health care debate, which Obama wants to get, wants to transform health care before the August recess, he's going to need as many Democrats as he can get.
Kathleen, what do you see? President Obama's been out of the country quite prominently, and we'll talk about that. But at home, what about his priority list? What's going on?
Well, you know, the Blue Dog Democrats have rallied against Obama at this point, and everybody's watching their own back, obviously. You know, you've got the 2010 elections are around the corner at this point, and nobody wants to have trillion-dollar debts attached to their name. So I think, you know, part of it is just simply people are kind of beginning to listen more to the constituents. The American people are getting the message that we're spending, and we don't really have a very good plan for covering that expense. And so, their enthusiasm is waxing and waning, and so, naturally, Congress is doing the same. So I think Obama's, he's really now kind of hitting the point where he is going to start getting a lot of gray hair.
Jack,
even
I want
more
to
than he's gotten so
no,
far.
No, it's already. I want him to start rinsing.
Oh, boy. Here we go. Jack, we'll come to you on hair color. Let's listen to the president himself. This is a press conference today in Italy. President firing back at critics, saying that the deficits are the big problem.
There's been a lot of talk about the deficit and the debt. And from my Republican colleagues, why isn't Obama doing something about this? Ignoring the fact that we got into the worst recession since the Great Depression with a $1.3 billion deficit. Fair enough. This is occurring on my watch. What cannot be denied is that the only way to get a handle on our medium and long-term budget deficits is if we corral and contain health care costs. Nobody denies this.
President Obama at the G8 summit in Italy said $1.3 billion deficit. Of course, he meant trillion inherited. Jack, what's going on here on health care and more with Obama and Congress?
Well, you know, he says that the key to controlling our fiscal future is controlling health care costs. And what do we find out recently from the CBO, the Congressional Budget? We find out that the public plan, which is supposed to be the only vehicle there that would put pressure downward on prices, is in fact not going to do that. That the public plan contemplated in the HELP committee, the health committee, would not do that, would pay at prevailing rates. And why is that? Well, why would they produce a plan that wouldn't get to the end that the president wants? Well, one reason is that the healthcare industry is spending $1.4 million a day on lobbying. Max Baucus is the chairman of the Finance Committee. Two of his former chiefs of staff are leading lobbyists for the healthcare industry. And everybody says, and it's the truth, you cannot control healthcare costs and allow the same level of profitability in that healthcare industry. These stakeholders have to give up something. It's clear they're not. It's clear that behind the scenes they are winning in the lobby. And meanwhile, the president seems becalmed. He seems to be letting this in the hands of Congress. You know, recently Harry Reid was asked, has the president said anything to you? Has he said, I must have this, I must have that? And Harry Reid said, the president has never said to me, I must have anything. Well, it's about time he starts to say that, because otherwise it appears we're going to have a plan that will expand coverage but do nothing about costs, and the result will be just the one he talked about, namely a fiscal future where we do nothing but pay for health care in this country.
Clarence Page, you've watched presidents and congresses for a long time. You hear Jack there. Here's Joe Klein in Time magazine writing that Obama has lost that focus. He says he's failed to speak with precision or clarity about the bills wandering through Congress. He's failed to make clear what needs to be in those bills and what can't be if he's going to sign them. What do you think, Clarence? What's your advice or view on White House and Hill?
Two things, Tom. One, Obama's a constitutional law professor, remember, mm-hmm. and he values the constitutional arrangement, which is, you know, the president proposes, Congress disposes, the president draws broad outlines and leaves it to Congress to fill in the details.
But there is the jawbone factor, jawbone.
Well, President Obama, that's number two. He's announced three bedrock requirements, as he calls it, for real health care reform. One, reduce costs. Two, guaranteed choice. Every American has a freedom to choose their own plan and doctor. And three, ensure quality care. Those are important outlines that he has put down. Now, he has not said, for example, a public option is essential. He was asked about this this week and last week. Rahm Emanuel said it was negotiable. Obama hardened his position a bit more after that, and said that there must be some kind of choice here. But he's been dodgy, and I think deliberately, about what he's demanding here, because it makes him a moving target. He's able to avoid the kind of assault that Bill and Hillary Clinton received in the early 90s. But I think if he does come out of this without a public plan, as Jack calls it, there's going to be a lot of Democrats, a lot of people in his base who are going to say, well, what was the point of all this?
Kathleen Parker, of course, the envelope for all this is the economy. Some rough news at the end of last week about June job loss figures, maybe something a little better this week, but retail numbers out that look, pretty bad. American consumers pulling back. Abercrombie & Fitch, I don't think the country will rise and fall on that, but sales down 32%, Target down 6.2%. What do you see in the economic wrapper that's around all these issues, Kathleen?
Well, I'm watching Baghdad Biden with awe. Because he's out there saying, No, really, everything looks great. You know, factories are opening and construction is beginning again. And I'm thinking, okay, Mr. Biden. But, you know, our unemployment rate is now higher than was originally projected. I think Obama had said all along that the stimulus meant that the stimulus package meant that unemployment would stay below 8%. It's now at 9.5%. And projections are that it will go up to 10 before it gets any better. You know, it turns out the Obama administration does not have a crystal ball. They're not seers. And what I think is most, you know, I'm not an economist, so I can't begin to analyze what's gone wrong. But I think one thing that's worth noting is that in every case, when I've spoken to people who are economists and who are close watchers of what's been going on and understand it, you know, I'll say things like, well, in creating the stimulus package and you know, you're obviously looking at some sort of model, you're projecting ahead, you have some sense of where this is going to wind up. And invariably, they sort of smile and shake their head and say, not really. The truth is, nobody really knows what's going to happen. And they're giving it their best shot. But, you know, it's history doesn't really necessarily support the outcomes that have been suggested. And I would like, if I can, just back up. Well, we'll come back to it. But I do have one little thing to say on the health care
hold the
question
thought,
before
Kathleen,
we leave it.
Yeah, Warren Buffett closing the loop on the stimulus package and sex this week, saying the first stimulus was sort of like taking half a tablet of Viagra. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. At a week in the news, Obama abroad, GM out of bankruptcy, and goodbye to Michael Jackson and to Sarah Palin as governor of Alaska. Kathleen Parker joins us. Clarence Page is here from the Chicago Tribune, our own Jack Beatty. Here's Republican John Boehner complaining this week about his own Ohio, saying the stimulus has not been effective.
Ohio's unemployment rate is above 10%. The nation's unemployment continues to rise. And families and small businesses across the country are asking, Mr. Vice President, where are the jobs? The administration promised the stimulus would keep unemployment below 8%.
Whoops, that didn't happen. Mr. Vice President, I guess because Biden is headed to Ohio. Kathleen Parker, you were saying on health care.
Well, no, I would love to quote one of us today, but since we are referring to other commentators, I thought Michael Kinsley had a great piece today in the Washington Post. It was so sane and simple. And what his point was that, you know, what is the big rush that we've attached this sort of urgency to the health care reform that grew out of the stimulus package and just this whole economic collapse? But in fact, we could slow down a little bit and take our time. This is so serious and so complicated. And he, you know, he laid out a few simple points like, you know, let's just take the things that we agree on, that everyone agrees on, and tackle those and then see where we stand. I mean, I think the Obama administration, of course, wants to get this through as quickly as possible before people completely emerge from, you know, the post-election stupor. But the fact is we could just apply the brakes and take this a little bit more slowly, take on malpractice reform. And Michael Kinsley even suggested, you know, let's reduce paperwork. How about we start there? We can cut lots of costs by taking some fairly simple measures. Anyway, I just thought that was worth throwing out there.
Jack Beatty, what about it? The last time we tapped the brakes, the whole thing fell asleep for, what, 15 years?
Yeah, I mean, the risk is that the lobbies just have much more time to gather for us. If they're spending $1.25 million a day now, if you lengthen that out over, say, I don't know, a year, they'll pretty much buy the Congress. And as we get close to 2010, more and more congressmen and senators are going to be for sale. They're going to be in the market. So I think that there is a window there where the public interest in a comprehensive plan is over here and the private interests are here. You know, in a way, Obama is paying for, we're all perhaps going to pay for, the absence of Harry and Louise ads. Harry and Louise are silent. Why? Maybe because they're getting what they want. And as we read from the New York Times this week, you know, from whether it's from Walmart or the hospital industry or the insurance industry, industry, the drug industry, side deals are being cut in the Senate that give them what they want and pay for their silence. Maybe we were better off with just something frontal. Harry and Louise, the interests versus the public interest.
Let's get a call from Lansing, Michigan, right here. Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I work with a large school district in Michigan, and I just wanted to comment that while we did receive our stimulus funds, we still have not spent any of it. It's still going through bid processes and school board approval. So we have received the money, but none of it's been actually used, and that might be potentially a symptom of why money doesn't seem to have done anything yet.
So what does that say to you? You need to speed up, Jerry, or perhaps the economy will turn up when you finally start spending in your school district?
Well, I don't work directly with the accounting aspect of it. Yep. I work with the creation and finding of the bids. My understanding is there were certain processes we had to go through. School board approval, we only have one school board meeting a month. Also, not fully knowing how much we were going to get initially, we only had tentative plans up front.
Right, but the shoe of that spending hasn't dropped there yet. Jerry, let me ask you, since you're calling from Michigan, what about GM out of bankruptcy? Is that a hallelujah development to you, or who knows, or what?
Well, yeah, I specifically live in Lansing, so I see all these big flat areas of cement where they ripped down some factories recently. I'm tentative. I'm not jumping up and down for joy yet. We'll see what comes of it, but you know, more than half the factories here in town are gone still, so.
Jerry, thanks very much for calling. Clarence Page, how about it? Jerry says, well, maybe, the money's just not spent yet. Where he looks at it, maybe that's the problem. He looks at GM and he sees fat slabs, no factory left.
Well, what is the problem? I mean, if people had looked, of course, nobody actually looks at the details of these things. You know, when this $1 trillion was allocated, the schedule was quite apparent right there insofar as what the states would be doing with it. They weren't going to just turn right around and spend it over the weekend like teenage boys out on prom night. This is allocated on. What I would say is have enough patience to wait until after Labor Day to see how the economy looks and the stimulus package looks. And then I think that's when the rubber hits the road as far as the Obama administration's accountability for this recession and for the recovery. There's a debate, furious debate between economists right now as to whether this stimulus package is enough, whether we ought to have more stimulus before or after the August recess or wait until some more of this gets spent. I would stand with those who say, well, let's wait a little longer. This recession didn't come about overnight. It's not going to be healed overnight.
Here's that tape from Warren Buffett, billionaire investor on Good Morning America, saying, well, maybe a second round, another round of stimulus may be necessary.
I think that a second one may well be called for. Any stimulus acts with a delay, including the first one, but it is not a panacea. A stimulus is the right thing. You hope it doesn't get watered down in many ways. I mean, our first stimulus bill, it seems to me, it was sort of like taking a half a tablet of Viagra, you know, and then having also a bunch of candy mixed in, you know, as everybody was putting in things for their own constituencies. And it doesn't have really quite the wallop.
Warren Buffett on the first round of stimulus. Speaking of half a tab, let's look abroad for a second to that G8 meeting and what went on there on emissions and global warming. Kathleen, I don't know how closely you follow this. Of course, everybody's trying to set dates and bring down carbon emissions and rein in climate change. But the old divide here between developed and developing nations emerged again. Developing nations not willing, China and India in particular, not willing to sign on as it was hoped they would, and maybe half a loaf out of Rome on climate change. How do you look at that, Kathleen?
Well, I have not followed climate change as closely as others have, but I don't think anybody's surprised that the developing nations are not willing to sign on. That's been a consistent pattern, and one of the reasons we've sort of stood back over the last 8 years. But I think the G8 needs to take a position of leadership, and the goal of cutting emissions by 80% by 2050, You know, it seems like a step in the right direction as long as we can keep our economy afloat. But that's the big question. And, I would leave that to people who are better versed in these things than I am. I wanted to just, if you don't mind me flipping back a little bit, because every time Clarence is talking, I think of something I want to say.
Sure.
And I think it's important to note, on the stimulus thing, if I can just say one more thing. You know, 90% of that money has not yet been spent. So, and the problem is, of course, it's getting hung up in bureaucracy. That's always the problem. And, the other problem is that much of it is being spent in rural areas versus the metropolitan areas where 2/3 of the population lives. So there are a lot of snags already in the stimulus package that's been presented. And this will be the key issue in 2010. And I would say that the Republicans are doing a very good job of distancing themselves from any responsibility, any kind of connection to that package. And I think, this is, as a political issue, this is huge for the 2010 elections.
Obama,
if I can just dovetail on that.
Clarence,
we had a caller from Michigan and talked about John Boehner from Ohio. Those are two of the hardest hit Rust Belt states here that need the stimulus money. They're getting the money. It takes a while for it to filter down to the local level. Meanwhile, Obama's polling has been suffering in those two states and in other areas where the economy is hitting the hardest. So I think, Kathleen's right. As we get toward the 2010 elections, of course, this becomes more and more important. But for right now, I think, as I said, rubber meets the road in the fall as we watch the same opinions, pollings, and the local economies.
Let's get a call from Dan in Boston. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, John. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, I guess, for everyone on the show. The climate change bill also made news this week, and the fact that it seems that the White House and also the Congress seems to have almost pushed the back burner a little bit and said that they're going to take care of it later in the fall. And I guess, sort of without debating the merits of the bill, which I think are questionable in a lot of ways, I think that the bill could have a lot to do with the stimulus package in that it has the potential to create a lot of free new jobs and retrain people for sort of the coming green economy. And I find it sort of interesting that if they're so focused on improving the economy and getting that stimulus money out, I guess I personally see a connection between, whether I guess the relative speed with which they're gonna push that bill forward. And I was wondering if the people on your show agree with me or not.
But we'll pick it up, Dan. Slow down in Washington on climate change, and let's pull that together a little bit with what happened at the G8, where, again, there had been a draft communique committing to something like a 50% cut in worldwide greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Industrial countries, the U.S., cutting theirs by 80%. Developing countries said no way to that 50%. Jack Media, I was struck this morning. I'm going to play some tape here from Ken Lieberthal at the Brookings Institution talking about that failure. We can look at both that and what's going on in Washington, but listen to just how sober he is about the implications of what did not happen with a bigger push from the G8 and how he's assessing the road ahead on climate.
I think it's going to be very, very hard to avoid a catastrophe. So I think anyone who looks very seriously at this issue has to say that the future looks very, very sobering.
I mean, this is a field, Jack, where there's been all kinds of rhetoric, but here's a serious guy saying very, very hard to avoid a catastrophe.
Yeah, and here's the New York Times this morning. Without China's participation in the fight, the fight against global warming is essentially lost. Essentially lost. And, China and India rightly say, you industrialized countries have been, industrialized since the 18th century. We're just getting into it. We want to raise the standard of living of our people. We have to go ahead with this. Now, and what's the track record? I mean, I think it was 2007, the industrializing countries were promised a big subsidy from the developed countries. That didn't come apart. There have been promises, and nothing has been done. And so they look at the advanced world, and they say, look, unless you're going to give us the clean technology that allow us to go forward in a salubrious way, we're just going to go forward. We're going to keep building, that coal plant a week in China. And anything we do here or the Europeans do is meaningless. And that's the point. I think we in the developed world has to get it. unless the Chinese and Indians are aboard, anything that happens here won't matter. It'll all be canceled out by what happens there. And therefore, it is one world, under the cosmos here, in the planetary sphere. And yet you just sense again and again that national interest prevails. You know, here how small, how really meager our bill is against the necessities, and then the Europeans with all their parochialisms. It's as if the planet has got to wake up, as if it's waiting for a kind of climate Pearl Harbor or something.
Not exactly a great ramp to the big meeting in Copenhagen later this year. Let's get a call from Robin in Schenectady, New York. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to say the Sarah Palin issue. During the campaign, it came out that she forced women to pay for rape kits in the town she was the mayor of many years ago. Those can cost a couple $1,000s. And so what's happening is no shock. It shouldn't be any shock to anybody. And she's basically proving she can be as bad as any man. And that also ties into the health care, because I've heard on a competing program that Connecticut and Massachusetts have had cases where hospitals have pursued people for not paying their bills criminally. So it ties into the health care issue, and because when you go in for these things, you know, it's the only way to pursue a rape case.
Robin, let us pick up the Sarah Palin issue. That's an interesting one. We've got Kathleen Parker with us, who has been pretty famous on this front. Kathleen, way back early on, you had your column back September 26th, not long
yes.
after she was put up as John McCain's running mate. The Palin problem, your headline was, she's out of her league. Now she's very soon out of the governor's office in Alaska. What's your postscript on the Palin story, Kathleen?
How much time have you got?
2:46
well,
before the break, but let's go.
Let's just say I'm feeling better about myself. You know,
as you should.
Yeah, well, the September 26th is a date I remember because it was my birthday, and I got 11,000 emails for my birthday. From
Happy
people who
birthday,
wished,
Kathleen.
Thank you. Yes, exactly.
But not really.
What was I thinking?
But the tone was not exactly congratulatory.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was sort of... suddenly, there were a lot more people who favored abortion, and I was one. I should have been one of its victims, but that's literally the way it was put. Mm. Well, look, I think Sarah Palin was clearly out of her league then, and I want to say this just because I can. I never really set out to be the Andy Palin. That was not my goal in life. And
you were
I really
firmly
just
in the conservative camp when you came
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I was
this.
Very pro Palin when she first came out, just simply because I liked her spunk and her spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that there was this new sort of feminist profile that needs to be out there because all women are not one thing. So there she was, and I just assumed at the first that she had been properly vetted and that she was qualified. That seemed not to be the case by the third interview with now famously known as the Katie Couric interview. So I did come out and suggest that she retreat to Alaska. When she finally did do that, she found that she no longer likes being governor of Alaska and, as everybody knows, has submitted her resignation. It seems to me, I've talked to lots of people who are very close and many people who are Palin fans otherwise, but who are realists and can speak truth about what's happened. And yes, she's just fed up. That's one level of truth. She's had it. She's tired of being under siege. She was very hurt by the attacks on her children. And I don't blame her for that. But the other side of that is that she is now a very marketable commodity. She can become very wealthy and fully intends to. She can also raise a lot of money for the Republican Party. So most people that I've talked to in the party, sort of in the behind-the-scenes leadership, are delighted by Sarah Palin's decision because this removes her from the scene. She needed to be removed. She was a bit of an obstacle to the party developing any sort of credibility. But they wish her well. They hope that she'll raise money for other candidates and can find some balance in her life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been a week of sport and satire and song. Lance Armstrong pedaling away in another Tour de France.
Never far from the front end of the main field is Lance Armstrong. It's always difficult the first day in the mountains because you never really know how your body's going to react.
He's back. Opening today is Bruno, Sacha Baron Cohen's latest mockumentary about a flamboyant Austrian fashion journalist. Here's Cohen on the Today Show explaining the conflict in the Middle East.
The Palestinians have got their enemies, you know, the Israelis, but I've got my enemies too. My enemies is carbohydrates. You know, I've had to declare jihad on Haagen-Dazs.
And Jennifer Hudson gave a memorable performance at the Michael Jackson Memorial. She sang Jackson's Will You Be There?
Hold me like the river of Jordan, and I will then say to thee, you are my friend.
It was quite a send-off for the King of Pop. Listeners, you can join the conversation. What's up with the Republicans, Ensign, Sanford, Palin? What about Joe Biden and his quips, maybe gaffes, in recent days? Clarence Page is here with the Chicago Tribune. Kathleen Parker with the Washington Post Writers Group and our own Jack Beatty. Clarence Page, how about Michael Jackson and his big, big exit there? Your last thoughts on this giant entertainer, whatever you think, anyone may think of the media's coverage of his death and its observance.
Yeah, how many more hours do we have?
Oh,
Tom?
Boy, okay.
I'm listening to all that news you're talking about. You know, this going on here. It's amazing. Let me say as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. It's been interesting this week to see the anti-Michael Jackson backlash emerge.
Yes.
Where Congressman Peter King of New York and another congressman from Kentucky expressing what, of course, a lot of people are thinking. I know because I get the emails from both sides. People saying, why are you making such a big deal about that pervert, as Peter King calls him. And I think that's a legitimate question because it says something about what a diverse country we are. Michael Jackson is a superstar. When you're dead, I mean, I remember an Irish Catholic priest once told me, you know, speak not ill of the dead. Mm. And you hear this all the time. It's part of an American tradition. Death does reduce one's sense of envy or resentment. And a lot of people were willing to put that aside and recognize that Michael Jackson's music since 1970, for us boomers and beyond, represents the background music to some of the most pleasurable times of our lives, to our youth. Just watching him dance was a sensation. Fred Astaire called him the greatest living dancer at the time. Fred Astaire was much older than he was in his prime, of course. I mean, you can go on and on. He was quite a remarkable, iconic figure who represented a lot in our lives. And in that sense, he'll be missed. For the other side, many of them are tin-eared. I feel sorry for them that they don't appreciate the body of music that he did put forth. Even my son, who now thinks Michael Jackson's music is kind of a square pop, was getting renewed appreciation over this past week.
Well, it was quite an observation. I mean, popular adulation demands its own attention. It certainly did in Michael Jackson's exit there.
Are you going to let me say something?
If you'd like to, Kathleen.
Please.
Well, only because I just wrote my column about it. I waited until after the memorial service to chime in because out of respect for those in mourning. And obviously, we can all say, I think we can all agree that the media coverage was over the top. But I thought what Congressman King said was reprehensible because a pervert and a low life. For one thing, what a blunt instrument. I mean, this doesn't come close to the tragic dimension of Michael Jackson's life. And I think what we need to focus on if we're going to talk about him more is not his abuse of drugs, but this death spiral that went on for at least the last decade and a half. This was a very troubled man, and he was, you know, my own observations are that he, you know, had lost a childhood. He was like he dangled his own baby over the balcony from that hotel. His family dangled him over the balcony he never had a chance to fully develop himself. For whatever reason, it appears he didn't pursue therapy or analysis to get to the bottom of his issues. Instead, he kept trying to transfigure himself into some sort of idealized whole person. So I think, you know, there's a lot to say about Michael Jackson's life, and it says something about our celebrity culture. It says something about our sexualized culture, and as well as the lost childhood that is a plague on our society.
Jack, we'll move to the news, but I mean, call me a prisoner of pop, but I was quite moved by the big ceremony at the Staples Center in Los Angeles somehow. I didn't expect to be, but then I was.
I have to plead nolo contendere. I didn't watch, and I'm not really attuned to it, so sorry to see him go.
Sorry to see him go. A great artist, whatever else may be said. Ted in Burlington, Vermont. Ted, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Quick point before I get to my question. One is Sarah Palin and John Boehner. They're not serious people, and we're in serious times, so I'm glad that Sarah's gone. And John Boehner, I mean, that guy doesn't come up. He's never come up with a real idea in his life. As far as China is concerned, I'm wondering why it is that the media. There's no excuse for what the Uyghurs have done. But I was just reading in The Economist recently that the Chinese government is basically forcing Han people into the Uyghur territory, for lack of a better word. And this is really a self-defense mechanism. It doesn't excuse their actions, but it's what they did with Tibet. And they're doing it with these folks. Again, I don't know why the media is not covering this. We're all calling them, you know, savage Uyghurs. And what they did was savage, but it's pretty much self-defense at this point. So,
Ted, we've got it. I've missed some of the savage Uyghur commentary, if you've heard it. But clearly, blood in the streets, are 156 dead. The violence went both ways, but a lot of enraged Uyghurs fighting with security forces and Han, that is the central Chinese ethnic group there, out in Urumqi, way out in western China. Jack, have you followed this at all? Here's China dealing with its own diversity, shall we say. And Ted's quite right that many, many Han Chinese have moved into this territory in recent decades. Uyghurs, I guess, feeling really up against the wall. Muslim, a different ethnic group, a different culture entirely, really, with China and the Han Chinese, you know, all over them.
Yes, and to Americans, it should be a reminiscent pattern. I mean, the expansion of a great imperial power, annexing a new area, essentially through demography and forced migration and the incentives for migration, sort of outweighing the native population. And, you know, empire continues to be, we speak of China as if it's one unit, if it's one nation. Well, it's a cobbling together of nations and of peoples. And Han Chinese expansionism is something that's very, very old and almost irresistible. And it sounds as if these Uyghurs, their culture, their language, their way of life, all of this has been a casualty of this drive toward settlement there.
Kathleen, turn with us, if you would, to another big setting for international attention this week, Moscow. President Obama there trying to still hit that reset button. How do you think he did with the guys, Medvedev and Putin in the Kremlin?
Well, I'm having trouble gauging how effective he was without having seen Putin and Obama compare dogs.
Bo and Putin's, I don't know what his dog's name is.
You know, when Putin brought his dog out to George W. Bush, he said, "See my dog? Bigger, stronger,
bigger dog.
Faster."
The Russian way.
Well, look, I tend to think of President Obama's being a bit of a kind of a graduate of the Alan Alda School of Foreign Policy.
Now, what is that exactly?
Well, he just wants to get along. And, you know, he's sensitive and he's trying this whole new approach. To criticize that approach in any way is not to endorse the one that preceded it. But I think there's some concern, legitimate concern about his this new agreement he has fashioned, in which we have, you know, we're talking about limiting our defense arms along with our offensive arms.
This is nuclear stockpiles,
exactly,
the U.S. and Russia.
Exactly. Mm. And, of course, that's what Russia has always wanted, because we're way ahead of them. We can stop an intercontinental ballistic missile. They can't. So we're now putting restrictions on our ability to do that, which must be unsettling to NATO members, and particularly places like Poland and the Czech Republic. So I'm I'm not so thrilled with what he's accomplished. I love the idea of a nuke-free world, but I think we have to be a little bit more realistic.
Are you talking about the missile defense system that the U.S. has wanted to put into Europe and Czech
Republic and Poland? Well, I think part of the agreement is that we would curb our progress toward that. Yeah. If I'm wrong about that, somebody
can correct
me.
Well, it's not stated, but it certainly seems to be, at least under the covers.
Well, the link is there. The link has been established.
It seems to be kind of incremental, but it was important to the Russians that Obama make some concessions toward the end of the week. After early in the week, they had this agreement to cut back nuclear stockpiles by a third. The Russians, this is why Obama got such a cool reception in Moscow compared to Paris and London and Berlin and all, because the Russians kind of tend to view him more as, well, another American president come to fleece us and offer nothing. And so Obama's well aware of that. I think we started to see some of that toward the end of the week because what's really important to them is those missiles in Poland, what we call Eastern Europe, Central Europe. It's sort of an incremental concession. We will see over the long run what it means, though.
Let's listen for just a second to a little bit of President Obama. Maybe this is what Kathleen Parker would call the Alan Alda approach, but sort of trying to reason with the world, reason with Russia.
Neither of us would benefit from a nuclear arms race in East Asia or the Middle East. That's why we should be united in opposing North Korea's efforts to become a nuclear power and opposing Iran's efforts to acquire a nuclear weapon.
Maybe it's Alan Alda, but it does seem reasonable. What do you say, Jeff?
I liked Alan.
Yeah, sure. but you didn't put him in the White House.
He's the kind of guy I wanted to date.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just not sure he's the right guy in the foxhole.
Jack, what about it on the foreign front?
It does seem reasonable, but, you know, you can't reset history. And the history is that two American administrations in a row, to the Russian point of view, have betrayed promises. The Clinton administration, well, actually it was the Bush administration, and going out of office, promised, no, we're not going to expand NATO. Clinton, partly out of domestic political promises made in Chicago, did expand NATO right up to Russia's borders. President George H.W. Bush said, the last president, I keep forgetting it's H.W. or he said, he came up with this putting the missiles in Eastern Europe against ostensibly Iran. Neither of those go down well with the Russians, and Mr. Obama isn't able to reset them. I mean, it's a new president, but there aren't new policies. He's the hostage of the bad will those policies have created, and he doesn't seem willing to change them. Now, he did say on the missiles in Eastern Europe that, you know, if progress can be made with Iran, if we can get Iran to stand down on its nuclear development, we won't need those missiles. When the Russians come back and say, well, yes, but how about taking the missiles off first, and then we'll help you with Iran? It may be the president is going to have to choose. Do you want those missiles in Eastern Europe, which are meaningless, really? Or do you want real progress made with Iran? Do you want Russian help there? And I think the Russians are going to confront him with that choice. And I don't understand why, since we have elections in this country, you can't change the policies of your predecessor when those policies seem not to be all that prudent. Mm.
Let's get a call from Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi. Regarding Robert McNamara, who has been pretty much blamed for the Vietnam War, of course, it's only a president who's really responsible for that. But in an old interview that I saw on TV recently, McNamara said, you cannot go into a country and start fighting it, start a war with it, when they are in the stress of a civil war themselves, which was happening, he said, a few years too late in Vietnam. But now we have really caused a civil war by going into Iraq. And now that this is our eighth war since World War II, when Roosevelt said we must not have any more wars. But when you think of Vietnam, we have to think also of Iraq now, where more than 1 million people have been killed there, and there's no stress about that. There's no mention of it even in any of the media. 1 million people mourning over there for their loved ones, and 1 million of them dead. How can we just face the fact that we've done this again?
Jackie, let us look at the McNamara legacy in the time we have. Clarence Page, your thoughts on Robert McNamara and U.S. foreign policy, U.S.
quickly,
wars.
as one who was drafted 2 years after McNamara had already secretly decided that the war was unwinnable but didn't know how to get out of it, I've always had an interesting relationship with him. I finally met him here a few years ago in Washington in the late 90s, actually. Found him to be, as that movie, that award-winning movie came out of, what, 2 or 3 years ago, about him shows, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's a technocratic guy who is quite full of regret over the mistakes made in the war. The big mistake being that we believe the domino theory. He believed the domino theory we had to stop the Vietnam communists, otherwise they'd roll over the rest of Southern Asia and beyond. And the sense of deja vu all over again that I got as in the run-up to the war in Iraq was profound. And now it makes me quite depressed, because 40 years ago I thought, at least we won't make this mistake again. And we have.
Jack, last thoughts on Robert McNamara?
Well, you know, listening to the tapes, the Johnson tapes, the conversations between President Johnson and McNamara, I'm reminded of something D.H. Lawrence said. He said that the Pequod, the ship in Moby Dick, was a figure for America, a maniac captain of the soul with three eminently practical mates. Well, there was the maniac captain of the soul in Johnson, obsessed, depressed, driven to end this frustration of his ambitions. And here was the eminently practical mate. Any crazy thing Johnson wanted to do, can do, Mr. President, will do, Mr. President. I'm a systems analyst, Mr. President. I can get it done, Mr. President. And what did he say at the end in that film? He said, I didn't realize we were up against nationalism. And
that's
all
right.
The systems analysis in the world, all the can do in the world, can't change that, can't reverse the will of a people.
It was the Civil War.
That's a pretty big oops. Kathleen Parker, we've got 10 seconds. A last thought on McNamara?
Well, I think oops was good, and I think our previous commitment to not speak ill of the dead should probably stand.
And we'll stand right there. Very grateful to each of you for being with us. Clarence Page with the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Don.
Kathleen Parker, nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Kathleen, great to have you again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And Jack, thanks as always for being here. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.